I think I want to say something.
Welcome to the British edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Margaret Thatcher.
I like to think that you look a bit more like Nick Clegg.
Ron, why are you doing a Cary Grant impersonation to open up this week's? There's very serious, traumatic things that happened this week. Three things in particular.
There was the bomb scare in Times Square.
Right.
Which fortunately did not take any lives. We have the terrible continuing spill of oil in the Gulf of Mexico.
And worse, and the worst thing of all.
We have the return of James Traficant to politics in Ohio. Ken, how did this happen?
Well, I think we should start with the most important or the most current news, and that is the botched Times Square bombing by that U.S. citizen from Pakistan.
Faisal Shahzad.
And while we are very thankful the way it ended and he was apprehended, there are a lot of questions.
I think the question that many people have is, how far away really was he from being able to detonate a deadly blast in this extraordinarily highly symbolic and overpopulated area of New York? Not that far. Not that far. So we all are asking, how many other people are there out there like Faisal Shahzad?
And then on the way to the airport, he makes the reservation. He pays for the flight in cash. His name is belatedly added to a no-fly list.
That day.
And yet he gets on the plane anyway, with the airlines not checking that until hours later.
This was the airline of Dubai, correct? Right. United Arab
Emirates, right?
That's right. Emirates. And they were apparently not as responsive to all of the regulations that they supposedly operate under as was presupposed. And we appear to have been lucky to have kept him from getting out of U.S. airspace.
And so we talk about what could have happened, and of course it didn't happen, and everybody's breathing a sigh of relief, but we could have lost him. He could have gotten on the plane and left. The Pathfinder could have detonated. There were so many what-ifs. And then we're back to blame again. And for all we know, the return of Dick Cheney and how who kept America safe and who didn't.
But in this particular instance, the bomb did not go off and the suspect was apprehended. So we will see what the next incident is. And that, I think, is the real question mark, is how do we stop people from doing this kind of thing before they get the chance?
And now the political fallout is whether he should have been read his Miranda rights. There are a lot of Republicans who say this man is a terrorist. He should not be charged as a civilian and the rights should not be read.
But he is a United States citizen.
Right.
And under what law do you start determining which United States citizen has rights and which does not, depending on what may be his politics?
Right, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. We're talking about law and we're talking about reaction to potentially horrific action. And I think that's where the politics part comes.
And a certain number of people have jumped on this, both commentators and politicians. You've got people like John McCain, somewhat surprisingly, out there saying, well, we really shouldn't worry too much about this citizenship thing. I mean, in certain kinds of cases, we just have to go ahead and, turn mother's picture to the wall and turn the founding father's pictures to the wall and go after these terrorism suspects for the monsters that they are and not give them these protections, which is a bit surprising coming from John McCain.
A lot of things are surprising coming from John McCain.
Who,
lately,
after all, was the man who stood up to the George Bush regime on the whole question of torturing suspects and the whole question of giving people rights. So obviously the political atmosphere has changed a little bit, at least for certain individuals.
Glenn Beck, I think this may be the first time I'm quoting Glenn Beck on this podcast, but Glenn Beck said he is still a U.S. citizen. And as far as I know, U.S. citizens are afforded certain rights. So Glenn Beck is on the other side of that equation.
And he's not alone on the right, Glenn Beck, either. There have been a number of other conservatives who have said we can't get into the business of selectively protecting U.S. citizens. Maybe we should be more careful about who to whom we grant citizenship. Maybe that vetting process needs to be a little bit more thorough. But once those citizenship rights are granted, we can't pick and choose.
That was conservative philosophy from day one.
And still is, and still is for an awful lot of people on the right, even though, of course, they experience the extreme dissonance of wanting to be able to question a suspect like this to the maximum.
The other ongoing tragedy is what's going down in the Gulf with Louisiana and the coastal area where the BP oil spill, which comes not long after President Obama said, well, maybe we should drill, baby, drill.
That's right. He was saying we should at least open up some areas and, you know, trying to find some ground of compromise with the Republicans on the energy issue so that maybe they would stop resisting his climate change bill, which is obviously an energy as well as environment bill. And that olive branch was not really getting him very far. And then this happens. And now he is in a sense, on both wrong sides of the issue. He isn't doing enough for the people who want to drill, baby, drill, and at the same time, he's opened himself to the criticism that he's not doing enough to protect the environment. And you know, you say that this is going down in the Gulf. The problem is it's coming up. It's turned into geyser permanente. It's just up and up and up and up out of the earth, and we have no idea what the limits on this are. Weeks, months, how long is it going to go on?
And a lot of politicians have done an about-face as well on the oil issue. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Charlie Crist, who used to be, as a matter of fact, he still is the governor of Florida.
That is correct.
But he used to be a Republican, and now, as part of his non-Republican bona fides, he is saying that maybe drilling is not the way to go. Schwarzenegger was going to realize all this money from the oil.
Theoretically,
right.
Someday they were going to solve the California budget crisis with the revenues from the oil. Crist is very interesting because, in a sense, he's already had two big flyovers over the Gulf. He's clearly jumping on this issue in a big way, partly because his opponent, who has taken away his nomination of the Republican Party for the Senate, Marco Rubio, is still saying drill, baby, drill. He's unrepentant, like Sarah Palin and many others in the Republican Party, saying bad things are going to happen. Let's try to prevent the bad things, but we have to be out there getting this offshore oil.
Yes, but there are Democrats, too. Mark Warner of Virginia, there are others, Jim Webb, I believe, as well, are both still pro-drill for oil Democrats who have not recanted on that philosophy. But obviously, things change, and this oil spill perhaps may change the whole tenor of the debate.
If any of that oil reaches Florida's beaches, I would predict that this will be a big boost for Charlie Crist's comeback. If there's going to be one, this could be the kind of issue that would lift him.
Now, not to quote polls, because we're still talking about May 2010, but there is a new three-way poll put out by Rasmussen that shows that Crist leading in a three-way race. About 2 weeks ago, it was Marco Rubio with the lead. And so now Crist has a slight lead. Again, talking about polls in May is whatever, but still, perhaps maybe there is some political life left to Charlie Crist. We now know there will not be a Republican primary for the Senate in Florida in August, but there were primaries this week in Ohio, North Carolina, and Indiana.
And those were pretty exciting. Well, maybe not that exciting. In North Carolina, they still have a hung jury. We still don't have a winner there. Elaine Marshall was close to getting to the 40%
threshold. 37%, right?
37. But she didn't quite make it, and so she'll have to have a runoff on June 22nd with Cal Cunningham. Well, how do you assess the Elaine Marshall? She strikes me as a bit of a Kay Hagan kind of candidate, the woman who came out of nowhere to win in North Carolina in 2008.
Well, the difference, of course, is Kay Hagan was out of nowhere to defeat Elizabeth Dole. Elaine Marshall has been four times elected Secretary of State. Matter of fact, the first time she was elected, she beat Richard Petty, the great NASCAR driver. But Elaine Marshall was underfinanced, did not have much support from female groups. Clearly, that the Democratic establishment in Washington really wanted Cal Cunningham. He was a one-term state senator, an Iraq war veteran. He was somebody they thought could be an exciting new face, as Kay Hagan was in 2008. But again, he only got 27% of the vote.
It was not really close between the two of them, so the question becomes the distribution of the other candidates' votes, particularly the third-place finisher.
Right, and that was Ken Lewis, who African-American, who, again, looks like, once again, we're not going to have an African-American in the Senate with Roland Burris leaving. Ken Lewis is one of the highly touted black candidates, but against somebody with much more money like Cal Cunningham and with more name ID like Elaine Marshall, he was not going to go anywhere. But the good news for the Republicans here is that Richard Burr, the Republican incumbent, could sit back and wait six more weeks while the Democrats battle it out with each other. There's a lot of resentment of Washington, as there was in Indiana. We'll talk about that in a second, but there was in North Carolina, there was resentment among some Democrats that the Democratic establishment was trying to force Cal Cunningham on them.
Even though Cal Cunningham is, after all, a very North Carolina oriented and rooted candidate. It wasn't like somebody brought in a carpetbagger of some kind. They were obviously trying to find somebody they thought would have a better profile to beat Richard Burr. And Richard Burr's numbers have been kind of anemic. He's only a one-termer so far, and he's been under 50% in a lot of polls, and the Democrats were really hoping this might be their one takeaway in the whole country.
But he has tons of money, and again, six more weeks of Democrats spending money against each other is probably good news for Burr. What do you make of what happened in Indiana?
See, Indiana fascinates me because here's Dan Coats. He's 66 years old. He served in the Senate for about 10 years. He was appointed to the Senate in 1989 to replace Dan Quayle, who became vice president under
the first
George Bush. That's right. Had been elected in 1980. So he was a well-known figure at the time and a very acceptable appointee. Then was confirmed by the voters, if you will, in 1990, elected in his own right in 1992, and surprised an awful lot of people when, in late 1996, he decided to step out and not run for re-election in 1998, in part because the state's very popular young governor,
Evan Bayh, right,
was going to run in 98 against him. And he said at the time, I want to see what else God might have for me in life. I want to see where else God might be leading. I don't want to spend my whole time in politics. And so he voluntarily left the Senate in 1998, became ambassador to Germany under the second President Bush, and then left that job in 2005 and stayed here in the Washington area as a dreaded L word.
He also shepherded the very famous nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. That's on his resume, too, that has done.
Yeah, that's one of those things. He's got a couple of little exposures, apart from the fact that he is usually a 100% American conservative union voter and very reliable on social issues,
though
on economic issues. He had a couple of suspicious points,
one of them, he voted for a semi-automatic temporary gun ban in the 1990s when he was in the Senate that conservatives found quite distasteful.
Oh, Second Amendment, right.
Second Amendment. And John Hostetler, the former congressman, Marlon Stutzman, who's a conservative state senator backed by Jim DeMint's political organization.
From South Carolina, which is, of course, very important in Indiana.
Well, Jim DeMint actually seems to be this national conservative right-wing leader.
He's the anchor. He's the anchor on the right for the Republican Senate in many respects.
Right, and conservative challengers like Marco, he was an early Marco Rubio supporter. He is picking and choosing. I think Chuck DeVore in California is another one of his candidates.
Yes,
he is looking to make the Republican Party as conservative as possible. And I think Stutzman's strong second-place finish, even though he finished 10 points behind Dan Coats, was an indication that there is a future to Jim DeMint as perhaps a possible kingmaker.
Yes, and his name comes up when people talk about possible vice presidential nominees in 2012
DeMint.
And so forth. DeMint. He is a well-traveled figure from the Senate and really has begun to fulfill that particular role. Another interesting thing about Dan Coats, though, is that he is not necessarily guaranteed a waltz back into the Senate.
Oh, not at all.
Because Brad Ellsworth, who's 51 years old, former sheriff, won in a usually Republican district, a swing district, but an often Republican district.
Clobbered Hostetler.
By clobbering its incumbent, John Hostetler, 4 years ago. And now, you know, it would have been probably, a lot of people would have thought, one of the endangered Democrats in the House elections this fall. Instead, he's applying for a promotion to the Senate. And he's going to run as the son of Indiana against Dan Coats, the lobbyist from Virginia.
Well, it's true, yes. I mean, it's one thing for the Democrats to say that Dan Coats was the anointed choice of the Washington establishment. Republicans can also say that Evan Bayh dropped out of the contest so late that the Democratic Party anoints its own candidate, Brad Ellsworth. But here's the thing that makes Republicans nervous. Ellsworth is telegenic. He's pro-life. He's pro-gun. He's pretty much a social conservative blue dog. Now, he did vote for the health care bill, and a lot of Republicans are going to go after him on that issue.
That may be his greatest vulnerability. I mean, surely he'll be tarred with all of the usual issues of the Democratic Party in general, but he can set himself apart from a lot of that. And if he can differentiate himself enough as a personality, I think he's a more attractive figure in a lot of ways for the average person in Indiana than Dan Coats.
Who's been out of office for over 10 years. That's a good point. 12 years he's been out of office. Plus the fact that the Democrats who've been complaining about Evan Bayh all these years that, oh, he's too pro-Republican, he's not Democratic enough. I mean, well, you have Brad Ellsworth, who's a real conservative.
At least as much as Evan Bayh, probably more.
In many issues. So it'll be a tough fight. Certainly it's a toss-up at this point. One more thing I want to add about Indiana. Dan Burton, the longtime Republican congressman from the 5th District there.
Survived with less than 30% of
exactly.
the vote in a, what, 7-way field?
Had there been one or two opponents, he would have gone down to defeat. As conservative as he is, he's not the most likable guy in the world or in his own apartment.
This is somebody who has served in Congress for, what, 3 decades?
1982,
longer than 33, right. And who got 29% of the Republican vote in the primary.
Now, he's a shoo-in in November. And the third state that had a primary this week, of course, was Ohio.
Lee Fisher,
the lieutenant governor.
Won by 10 points. A bit of a surprise.
Well, the polls had him up by 20. He had the endorsement of Ted Strickland, the governor. He had tons of money, much more money than Jennifer Bruner, who's the Secretary of State, which, just like with Elaine Marshall, women are not raising nearly as much as male candidates, and that's always been historically the case. But when you have statewide elected officials like Elaine Marshall and Jennifer Bruner, you think they might do better in the money-raising department, and they did not.
But in this case, both Marshall and Bruner did better better than the polls might have indicated they were going to do. And in Ohio, it wasn't enough, of course, to win her the nomination, but it did narrow the gap between them to just 10 points.
Right, and the Republican nominee, this is the George Voinovich seat in Ohio. The Republican nominee is Rob Portman, the former congressman, but more importantly, the former Bush trade representative and
budget director.
And budget director.
I think budget director may come up rather often.
Well, that's the thing. Given the poor economy in Ohio, the question is, do you blame the Democrats, which are Ted Strickland, Barack Obama, and Lee Fisher, or do you blame the Republicans, President Bush, and his budget director, Rob Portman, and that will decide who wins that race?
Yes, and that one appears to be pretty close. It appears to be one that could go either way. Is that your feeling, or do you think this will be part of the general trend to the Republicans this fall?
Well, I think Rob Portman is a very good candidate. I think he's a better candidate, stronger candidate than Dan Coats, for example, in Indiana. So right now, I think Ohio stays Republican. I'm not sure about what happens in Indiana.
And before we leave the Great Lakes region, before we leave Ohio, I do think we need to ask the question, Jim Traficant, back on the ballot, wasn't he wearing a number the last time we saw him? Wasn't he in federal prison?
He was, but now he's the heir apparent to return to Congress. No, I've used that joke many times, and I don't know why. He is running as an independent in the 17th Congressional District, where Tim Ryan, his successor, has been...
This is Youngstown, eastern Ohio.
Yeah, although that district has been reapportioned in the years since then. But he came out of prison in September, left the Democratic Party, has talked to some Tea Party folks, this is Traficant, and decides to run as an independent. There are still some people, for all his corruption, and this man is corrupt. He was convicted of amazing charges.
He was a Full Employment Act for investigative reporters, investigative watchdog groups. Everyone you can imagine had a dossier on
and
this
yet,
guy before he went to prison.
There are a sizable number of people who will still vote for him no matter what, which is wild.
He's their guy. I do understand. Ken, there are two primaries next week in Nebraska and West Virginia. Anything you'd like to say about those exciting contests?
No, but I will say that speaking of West Virginia, next week is the 50th anniversary of the classic West Virginia presidential primary between John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey, where religion, Kennedy's Catholicism versus the Protestant surroundings of West Virginia played a major role in the end of the Humphrey campaign and Kennedy winning the nomination.
And becoming president. And 1 week later, we have much more interesting primaries in Kentucky and Pennsylvania.
Absolutely. In Kentucky, that's the Republican primary for the Jim Bunning Senate seat. Rand Paul, son of Ron Paul, has a lead in the polls and some polls against the establishment favorite Trey Grayson, the Secretary of State. The news of the week is that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican minority leader, endorsed Grayson, which is not a surprise.
Didn't he recruit Grayson to some degree?
Yes, he did.
To sort of help suggest that Jim Bunning choose this time to retire?
Yes, but I wonder if Mitch McConnell will now be lumped with the other Republicans who are being considered as establishment. One thing I don't want to let go, because it's coming before next week's primary, this Saturday in Salt Lake City, the Republican State Convention in Utah. Charlie Crist is not in sync with all the Republicans in Florida. And John McCain, you could say that, is not in sync with all the conservative Republicans in Arizona. But Bob Bennett, not a true conservative?
Well, he voted for the bailout in the fall of 2008. And on the basis of that, both he and Orrin Hatch, the other senator from Utah, both very conservative Republicans, have been vilified, not only by the Tea Party, but by many other conservatives in Utah. And that is one of the big sources of the disconnect that suddenly has Bob Bennett in trouble.
The rules of the game in Utah is that if you don't get 40% of the convention vote, you can't even participate in the primary. Right now, Bob Bennett looks like he's in third or fourth place with 16% of the delegates. If he does not finish at least second place with 40% of the delegates, not only will he not be able to win the primary, he won't even be able to compete in the primary. And Bob Bennett, a conservative, will be the first victim of this anti-government, pro-conservative movement in this country.
All right. And one of the first victims of it, if you want to look at it that way, is Arlen Specter, who was certainly in the middle between the two parties previously and defected from the Republican Party in 2009, became a Democrat, and now is fighting for his own nomination as a Democrat to stay in his seat. And he is being challenged by Joe Sestak, member of Congress. Is that race too close to call, Ken, or do you think Specter survives?
Well, a month ago, it was a 20-point lead for Arlen Specter. Right now, the latest Quinnipiac poll had it within 8 points. And with 2 weeks to go, Sestak seems to be gaining. Arlen Specter is 80 years old, and there's a lot of money being spent by the Democratic Democratic Party establishment on behalf of Arlen Specter, as it was promised when he switched parties, but an upset could not be ruled out.
Before we go today, Ken, I think we need to note the anniversary of an event that was important in our young lives, the Kent State shootings on the occasion of the invasion of Cambodia in 1970.
The 40th anniversary, you know, I couldn't decide whether it happened a long, long time ago or whether it happened yesterday. I think the answer is yes to both. But the anger, the anguish in this country over that war and the excursion into Cambodia, you'll always think of May 4th, 1970, and the four people who were shot dead by Ohio National Guardsmen at Kent State.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Can you?